Lecture 3, Nazi Electoral Politics.
I'd like to pick up the story, continuing our discussion of Nazi campaigning and Nazi propaganda, to carry us into the year of decision, the year of 1932. In 1931, as the NSDAP gained membership, as the Depression deepened, as the fabric of Weimar political life continued to unravel, the NSDAP had become obviously the news story of Germany. The party did well in a number of regional elections over the course of 1931, gaining as much as 30% of the vote in a number of smaller states. The party had been included in a coalition, the so-called National Opposition, that had developed around Alfred Hugenberg, who was the head of the German Conservative Party. Hugenberg was an opponent of the Weimar regime and will play a role, as we will see, in future developments in 1933. In 1931, he invited Hitler and the NSDAP to be part of a conservative slash right-wing campaign against the Weimar government. What this coalition did, the so-called Harzburg Front, they all met at the town of Bad Harzburg, was to give Hitler entree into legitimate conservative circles. The Nazis were not seen as conservatives in Germany. Indeed, they weren't conservatives. And conservative voters were wary of the National Socialists, who seemed too radical. This Harzburg alliance with Hugenberg was a great press lord in Germany, owned a chain of newspapers. The Harzburg Front in 1931 would give Hitler access to major, relatively positive coverage in Hugenberg's newspaper chain. It was, in a sense, the kind of legitimation that National Socialism had lacked in conservative circles, so that a possible expansion now into the conservative electorate was seen as possible. 1932, however, would be the great year of challenge and the year of decision for Weimar and for the National Socialists. The Nazis opened the year with an impressive showing in the tiny state of Lippe. It's the sort of Rhode Island of Germany, a tiny Lilliputian state. But nonetheless, they received over 30% of the vote, and the Nazis trumpeted this as a continuation now of the momentum that had been generated since 1929. The Nazis made a great deal of this notion of inevitability, that there is this wave, this tidal wave of support following the party, pushing it inexorably toward victory. And so January, February were auspicious from the Nazi point of view, and the party was looking forward to the upcoming state elections in the two largest states of Germany, Prussia and Bavaria, elections which were set for April of 1932. The biggest decision confronting Hitler and the Nazis in the new year, however, had to do with the presidential elections, or the possibility of presidential elections. Paul von Hindenburg had been elected president of the Weimar Republic in 1925. It was a largely ceremonial office, though it did have the power to grant the use of Article 48 to the acting government of the country. Hindenburg in 1932 was up for re-election. The term of office was 7 years. Hindenburg was 85 years old in 1932. He was without question the most respected, most venerable figure in German politics. And Brüning had the idea that, well, rather than force this distinguished elderly gentleman to run a campaign in the midst of this sort of ferocious street fighting that was going on in Germany, that maybe the Reichstag could simply by acclamation make Hindenburg president for life. He wouldn't be around long. He had served Germany well. This would be a nice gesture, but also prevent any sort of divisive election campaign in early 1932. His term was set to expire in May. And so Brüning began canvassing the various Weimar parties to see what they thought about this. Virtually all of them agreed to an extension of Hindenburg's tenure, except the Nazis. Hitler, in what was a typical kind of bargaining position for him, agreed with Bruning's general idea. Yes, of course, we'd be happy to see the Feldmarschall, the field marshal's term extended, but we would demand two things. Bruning said, what is that? And Hitler said, well, that you resign as chancellor and that you call new Reichstag elections instead. Bruning believed this was a bargain that he could avoid, and so therefore he refused Hitler's offer. Hitler now had to decide whether or not he was going to challenge Hindenburg. It was an enormous gamble. It would put Hitler's new won prestige on the line, and it would force the Nazis to campaign against easily the most venerable figure in German politics. It also might mean forfeiting the support from conservative circles in Germany that were slowly being wooed by the National Socialists. Nonetheless, in January, after consulting with Goebbels and Gregor Strasser, other advisors, Hitler decided to challenge Hindenburg for the presidency of the Weimar Republic. The presidential campaigns of 1932 began in February, and the NSDAP was very well prepared indeed to conduct the campaign. The Goebbels and his propaganda staff now showed what it was capable of. The Nazis launched a massive media blitz that was unparalleled in German history. Millions of leaflets were distributed. Over 30,000 rallies, meetings, and demonstrations were orchestrated by Goebbels and his staff all over the country, from Aachen in the west to Königsberg in the east. Nazi speakers traveled the country from end to end in one tremendous demonstration of the possibilities of coordinated political campaigning. The Germans had seen nothing like this. Goebbels, from his office in Munich and then also in Berlin, circulated regular propaganda memoranda to the local operatives of the party. New slogans came from the party leadership each week, new posters, new leaflets, each coordinated with other events in Germany, so that the Nazis attempted to give the impression, and it was a fairly accurate one, that all Hitler had to do was to give the word to Goebbels, and then like a flash or like a spark all across the country, things fell into line. Posters would go up, leaflets distributed, and so on. Films were made and distributed, phonograph records, caravans of Nazis with loudspeakers blaring from the back of flatbed trucks became a part of everyday campaigning. Motorcycle convoys of Nazis moving across the country, campaigning in every small hamlet and village. SA marches, sometimes into working class neighborhoods where they fought pitched battles with the communists and the social democrats, might occur. And what the Nazis tried to convey here was that, unlike the other bourgeois parties, that they weren't afraid of the left. They weren't afraid of the communists. They would go into these working class communist strongholds and challenge the communists on their own turf. What the Nazis did would be to send a unit of the SA into these working class neighborhoods, chanting Nazi slogans. Invariably what would happen is that somebody would throw a bottle or a tomato out of a window of a high-rise apartment building at them. A scuffle would ensue. There'd be a melee. The police would be brought in. And the next day in the general bourgeois press, you would see Nazis attempt to recruit votes from in working-class neighborhoods assaulted by communists. Agitators. The Nazis could therefore be aggressive and then appear as simply being on the defensive. All they were trying to do, they maintained, was to reach out and save the German working class from the tentacles of Marxism. If the SA was out smashing heads on Saturday in a working class neighborhood, it was not at all uncommon on Sunday morning to see the SA march off in units to go to church. One of the problems that the Nazis had with middle-class voters, that they were very keenly aware of, was that their association was sort of with paganism. Alfred Rosenberg, who was the official theoretician of the party, had written a book called The Myth of the 20th Century, in which he not only attacked Judaism, but attacked Christianity as well. And all through the campaigns, the middle class parties in particular like to remind voters that the Nazis prayed to Wotan, that they were not at all part of the Christian community. So the Nazis do everything they can in 1932 to reverse this impression, to destroy this impression, and sending the SA off to go to church services on Sunday was one of the measures that they adopted. Attention to detail, to what the Nazis called Kleinarbeit, to the technique of propaganda, was really extraordinary. This would be the hallmark of National Socialist propaganda, and it was raised to new heights during the presidential campaigns of February and March 1932. The attention to things that we've already mentioned, to the color of posters, to slogans, what played well. If you read through the memoranda of Goebbels' staff, they're not concerned about content. The content, you know, they're anti. They're opposed to this. They're opposed to that. What they really care about is how things look, how things play. They didn't have the term soundbite in 1932, but if they'd had it, they would have used it. Not for television, obviously, or not for film, but for the leaflet, for the short, pithy statement, the clearly identifiable symbol, in this instance, the swastika. Carefully orchestrated campaign events and attention to details were the hallmarks of National Socialist propaganda. The Nazis continued on the in this vein through the first round of the election. Let me say also parenthetically about Hitler's own role in this. By 1932, Hitler had become the most identifiable person in Germany. His recognition factor, I suppose we'd say now, was extremely high. As a consequence, what Goebbels and his staff attempted to, they managed Hitler. Hitler's personal appearances in these campaigns were very highly choreographed affairs. On the day that Hitler was to speak in a major city, at the beginning of the day, busloads of people would be brought in from the surrounding villages and small towns. The Nazis were always careful to select auditoriums that were too small. The point was never to get a space that was too big. That you always, it was far more important to have people standing up around the edges or hanging out of the windows, or to have a crowd outside where you could put loudspeakers up. So during the course of the day, the Nazis would be out hawking all kinds of things, autographed copies of Mein Kampf, or little buttons with Hitler's picture on it, or all sorts of pennants and things. If the National Socialist, if T-shirts had been in existence in the early 1930s, the Nazis would have used them, and you would have had a Hitler T-shirt. These things were choreographed in a way, and I think the only thing even roughly approaching the kind of excitement and the organization that the Nazis tried to create around Hitler's appearances during these campaigns is a rock concert. It's the way they were set up. Hitler always came late. He was always coming in from somewhere else. There would be a series of speakers there to warm up the audience, to get everybody excited. And then Hitler would make his dramatic entry into the hallway and give his speech. Police reports on the response of the crowd are quite interesting about this, because they said, you know, what's interesting about this is that people are often quite disappointed about his actual appearance, his talk. It might have been, for example, the third one he'd been to in the day. But in some ways, it wasn't even his own talk, or certainly even the content. In many cases, the content was simply ridiculous. It was all a series of empty phrases. What was important was the event itself, creating the energy, the waiting, the tension to build for the appearance of the Führer. And then his arrival, all of the sorts of trappings of a superstar arriving for an event. This is the image that Goebbels wanted to create, and the one that he indeed did. Nonetheless, the outcome of the first round of the presidential election, in order to win the election, one candidate had to have 50% of the vote, had to have a majority. The outcome of the first ballot was in some ways disappointing for the Nazis. Hitler did not defeat Hindenburg. Hitler received 30.1% of the vote. The other candidates, the communist candidate received 13.5%, a conservative candidate 6.8%, and Hindenburg received 49.6% of the vote on the first ballot, meaning that a second runoff had to take place. In the runoff, Hitler confronted Hindenburg directly, and the Nazi party's propaganda geared up again. They attempted to associate Hindenburg with the unpopular emergency decrees of Brüning, to depict Hindenburg as an honorable man, a man who had served Germany well, a man with a distinguished career. But his time had come and gone. It was time for the leadership of the country to be passed to a new generation of Germans. And so the passing of the baton from the field marshal to the corporal, the veteran of the First World War, Adolf Hitler, was a theme that the Nazis tried to maintain. In the campaign's most dramatic stroke, Hitler took to the skies in a, not a whistle-stop campaign, but literally flew from appearance to appearance. This was the so-called Deutschlandflug, or Hitler's flight over Germany. The whole point of it was to create the image of a peripatetic Führer who literally descended from the clouds to make these appearances. For those of you who've ever seen the National Socialist propaganda film from the 1934 party rally, Triumph of the Will, made by Leni Riefenstahl, it begins with this very impressive shot of clouds and then Hitler's plane descending through the clouds, and then you see the shadow of the plane moving across Nuremberg in the shape, of course, of a cross. I mean, it's this kind of imagery that the Nazis certainly attempt to create. Nonetheless, in the runoff campaign, the Nazis fell short once again. Hitler received 36% of the vote, and Hindenburg became Reich President once again. Yet the presidential elections were of crucial importance for Hitler personally and for the National Socialist German Workers' Party. It vastly increased Hitler's public recognition and stature. He had dwarfed the other right-wing alternatives to the Weimar system, and it tended to put him and Hindenburg in the same league. He had confronted the old field marshal. They had done combat together. This is the way the Nazis like to present it, and so on. The Nazis had become the anti-system party in German political culture, the alternative party. And it generated great momentum in party recruitment. Membership continued to rise in the course of 1932. And those elections, the election campaigns, the presidential campaigns in March and in April, would serve as models for the Nazi campaigns that would unfold in the following months. In the two important state legislature campaigns in Prussia and in Bavaria. Those, in fact, together made another national campaign, and in the regional campaigns of the various states in the course of 1932. In fact, the presidential campaigns of that year were just the beginning. There were altogether in Germany in 1932, there were four major national elections. Now, to Americans who have become, I think, dizzy with presidential campaigns that seem to go on for years, this may not seem so striking. But here you have four national political campaigns in Germany that are mounted within a matter of months. The two presidential elections, that would be Reichstag elections or parliamentary elections, set for July 31st, 1932, and again in the first week of November of 32. In between, there were regional elections in virtually every German state, the most important being those we've already indicated in Prussia and Bavaria in April. And the Nazis continued to march from one electoral triumph to the other. 36% of the vote in Prussia, 32% in Bavaria, 36% in Württemberg, 31% in Hamburg, a city that had been a communist and social democratic stronghold. Then in May of 1932, with momentum still growing, the NSDAP received 48% of the vote in Oldenburg, a small state in northwestern Germany, 44% in Hessen, a social democratic stronghold. By the early summer of 1932, it did not seem at all outrageous to think that the NSDAP might indeed be able to achieve a parliamentary majority in national elections. As the Nazis continued to gain greater and greater electoral support, the Bruning government proved unable to reverse the tide of bad economic news and simply moved from crisis to crisis. Pressure on Bruning grew over the late spring and early summer. Business interests in Germany were increasingly unhappy with Bruning's inability to deal with the Depression and his inability to dismantle the Weimar welfare state, which many businessmen in Germany considered to be the major cause of the Depression in the first place. Bruning had been able to achieve the end of reparations, the so-called Hoover moratorium in 1931, but that proved to be not enough to halt the slide of his own popularity or the popularity of his government. Finally, when Bruning proposed settling the unemployed of the German cities on these large East Elbian estates, owned in many cases by aristocrats, Hindenburg and others close to the president had had enough. Conservative elements in Germany claimed that this was, quote, agricultural Bolshevism, and that Bruning had lost his mind. And what, I suppose the idea of settling unemployed workers from Dusseldorf and the Ruhr somewhere out on a farm in East Elbian Germany was probably not the greatest idea to come down the road. And it seemed in many ways to be a reflection of Bruning's own loss of control of the situation. People close to Hindenburg now began to pressure the old field marshal to get rid of Bruning, to appoint somebody else. Influential military leaders, especially General Kurt von Schleicher, were increasingly disappointed with Bruning's inability to strike a deal with the Nazis. Schleicher was one of those men, and there were many in 1932 conservative circles and in the military, who believed it would be possible to strike a deal with the Nazis. That Hitler could be controlled, could be tamed, was the term that was often used. Schleicher believed that the time had come to scrap the Weimar Constitution and establish an authoritarian regime, and he believed it would be possible to create a presidential government that would be further to the right and which could enlist the support of both the Conservative Party and the Nazis. He was convinced that the Nazis could be used, as he put it, to drum up support for such a conservative government, and that this conservative government would enjoy the support of industry, the army, and of influential people in the agrarian community. Using his influence with Hindenburg, Schleicher convinced the old field marshal to dump Bruning and to install a man so obscure, so Lilliputian in stature, that even people in his own party weren't quite sure who he was. In the spring of 1932, Bruning, after having conducted the support, the campaign for Hindenburg, was unceremoniously dumped by Hindenburg and replaced by Franz von Papen. Papen was a Catholic Center Party politician who would become chancellor in May of 1932. Papen's cabinet would be called a, quote, government of national concentration. He argued that this government would not be a government based on political parties, but would stand above parties. That was good, because the new government commanded almost no support whatsoever in the German Reichstag. Even the Catholic Center Party was opposed to Papen's chancellorship, and so the only support for the new government seemed to come from the conservatives. Schleicher believed that he had worked out a deal with the Nazis, that the Nazis had been bought off, that the Nazis would tolerate a Papen regime in exchange for Papen's rescinding a ban on the SA. The SA had been banned because of street violence in the spring. The Papen government, which was sworn in May of 1932, would quickly be dubbed the Cabinet of Barons because it contained no national political figures. All of the members of the new Papen cabinet were conservatives. Seven were noblemen, and three were industrialists, and another a director of a major bank. This was not a Volkskabinett, as the Germans would say, a cabinet of the people. And of course, the Social Democrats and Communists had a field day with their campaigns depicting the Poppin cabinet as finally capitalism has revealed itself with this Poppin cabinet. And the Nazis, of course, had a field day as well, because here was the Poppin cabinet wasn't simply conservative. The Nazis would refer to it as the reaction. These were reactionaries which had to be combated. Poppin sent signals to the business community that he was ready to roll back Weimar welfare legislation, and he decided to call for new parliamentary elections on the 31st of July, 1932. It was a calculated gamble, but Poppin believed that if he were able to convince the business community that he meant business in dealing with the Weimar welfare state, that he meant business in dealing with the left, that he meant business about doing away with the old Weimar Constitution, a constitution that virtually everybody in Germany now agreed was unworkable, that he would be able to somehow construct a right-of-center constituency that would give him, if not a majority, something approaching it in the Reichstag. Moreover, he used a clash between Nazis and communists in Altona, as a pretext to declare martial law in Prussia on July 20th, 1932, and in one stroke simply threw out the legally constituted social democratic government of the largest state in Germany. It is a reflection of the Social Democratic Party's commitment to democracy and its unwillingness to engage in revolutionary action, that when Poppin imposed martial law in a way that was blatantly illegal, the Social Democratic Party's leadership's response was to take the course to the German Supreme Court. The communists, as well as younger social democratic activists, were in the streets furious with the party leadership, and were organized to take action, but no signal from the party leadership would come. Poppin hoped to use this as a way of showing to the public, and particularly the conservative public, that he meant business in dealing with the left. This was the Prussian coup, as it was called, was his signal. If Poppin hoped to win support for his government with the coup in Prussia, he was sadly mistaken. The summer campaign for the July 31st elections saw the Nazi campaign machine operating at full throttle and in full effectiveness. The Nazis simply had never demobilized. They had kept going straight through the presidential campaigns and simply continued on into the summer campaign of 1932. It was a campaign compared to which even the presidential campaigns paled. Hitler crisscrossed the country, once again took to the skies in another Deutschlandflug. The NSDAP conducted what was easily the most sophisticated, well-financed, and effective campaign in German history. The Nazis tore into the government, attacking the Poppin regime. The party's financial situation was solid and membership still rising. There was an air of confidence about the party. It was, certainly Hitler never said it in public, but in meeting after meeting after meeting all across the country, the Nazis indicated that they expected to win a parliamentary majority in the elections on July 31st, and the SA had been put on alert that for the day after the elections on August 1st, the SA should be ready to seize power around the country. The NSDAP in the summer of 1932 appeared to be on the threshold of power. But when the votes were counted, the NSDAP had fallen short. The party, instead of receiving a majority, received approximately 38% of the vote. It made the Nazis, for the first time, the largest political party in Germany. But it was well short of the majority that the Nazis had encouraged people to believe. And, though they certainly didn't know it at the time, it was the high watermark of Nazi popularity in anything like a free election. The Nazis had peaked in the summer of 1932. In August, in very highly public negotiations, Hindenburg, who despised Hitler, largely because of the presidential campaigns, refused to appoint Hitler as chancellor. Hitler's position was that he would not accept the position as vice chancellor, and indeed, he argued with Hindenburg, he wouldn't accept the position of chancellor unless he were given Article 48 power to rule by emergency decree. Hindenburg, who could barely tolerate the sight of Hitler, refused in both instances. Hindenburg kept referring to Hitler as that miserable bohemian corporal. I think this is because it was never quite clear. Hindenburg apparently believed that Braunau was from somewhere in Bohemia. It wasn't a reference to Hitler's lifestyle, but it was a reflection of Hindenburg's mental state, I think, at this time. Hindenburg was, in fact, suffering from bouts of senility in 1932, and that would play an enormously important role in 1933. Hitler was pursuing what within the party was called the all-or-nothing strategy. Either give me full power, or I won't enter the government at all. Hindenburg refused. Hitler's strategy caused considerable dissatisfaction within the NSDAP itself. Gregor Strasser, Hitler's lieutenant, believed that this had been a terrible mistake, that the time had come to actually enter the government, even if it meant being a vice chancellor to somebody like Franz von Papen. Hitler absolutely refused. Nonetheless, the situation for Weimar was not bright. In a scene that took on almost comic proportions in the Reichstag when the new government was convened, the largest political party in Germany provided what we would call the Speaker of the House for the Reichstag. Since 1919, that position had been held by a Social Democrat. Now, as the Reichstag convened after the July 31st elections, that position was held by that great parliamentarian, Hermann Göring, of the NSDAP. In a session in which Göring was supposed to turn to his, gavel the session to order, and recognize the chancellor, Franz von Papen, to come up to the podium to read the government statement, the initial statement, Göring, who had no easy task convening this Reichstag session. After all, you've got now 38% of the room is filled, I guess it would be over here, with Nazis. The communists were there, 15% or so here. The middle, which had shrunk down considerably, in the center. The Nazis were singing the Horst Wessel song, the Nazi party anthem. The communists breaking into choruses of the International, catcalls back and forth. Pandemonium, basically, in the room. Göring nonetheless gaveled the session to order. Papen stood up, preparing to be recognized. But before he could be, a communist delegate from the left jumped up and introduced a motion of no confidence in the government. Göring, this was completely against parliamentary procedure. Papen is waving his speech at Göring, demanding to be heard. Göring turns his back on him, and Göring's girth was substantial, could block Papen's view entirely, turns to the left, recognizes the communist deputy, accepts the motion, puts it up to a vote in the Reichstag. The Nazis and the communists vote to dissolve the Reichstag, and that's it. Before the government had even really been sworn in and taken action, it had been dissolved. But your reaction, to laugh, is exactly what most Germans did. Parliamentary government in Germany had been reduced to a farce. It was a joke. It didn't work. Parliamentary government had been brought to this condition in the summer of 1932, and there was no hope to get out of it. The Nazis and the communists, who certainly didn't cooperate, this was not something they had planned, and were mortal enemies, nonetheless had brought Weimar democracy to this pass. The Reichstag was dissolved, and new elections called for November 4th, 1932, the fourth national campaign of the year. The situation now for the Nazis was not quite so optimistic as it had been, or so propitious as it had been in the spring and early summer. For one thing, it's possible to keep telling your constituents, we stand on the threshold of power. This election is the last election. This time we're going to be in. This time we're going to have the majority. This time Hitler will be appointed chancellor. You might do that once, twice, three times. But the fourth national election in the course of the year, it was very, very difficult to convince people actually to come out to the polls again. Second, the party was running out of money. The NSDAP had received some funding from business sources in 1931 and in early 1932. But by no means was that a tremendous amount. Business sources in Germany had given far more money to the right-wing liberal DVP, the People's Party, and to the Conservative Party. Business gave money to anybody that opposed the communists. Nonetheless, the Nazi anti-capitalist rhetoric, this sort of blend of anti-Marxism and anti-capitalism, had scared off business interests by the summer of 1932, and business by and large supported the Papen government. By the fall of 32, that money was unavailable to the Nazis. The Nazis had charged admission to their propaganda events. By the fall of 32, people were tired of going out to the polls. People had seen these propaganda activities. As a consequence, there was a real loss of vitality in the campaign itself. The NSDAP was running out of gas, and they knew it. Nonetheless, Goebbels tried one last time to gear up the propaganda machine, to get out the vote, to get people out to campaign. The elections took place on November 4th, 1932. And when the votes had been counted, something extraordinary had happened. The NSDAP was still the largest political party in Germany. But for the first time since it began its remarkable ascent in 1928, the vote for the NSDAP in a crucial election had fallen. It had fallen from 38% to approximately 33%. And in a multi-party system such as the Weimar party system, in which you've got over a half dozen major parties and a host of smaller parties, that loss was considerable. The Nazis themselves were mortified by it. Moreover, in the aftermath of the campaign, the Nazis lost votes in regional and local elections in a number of locales in Germany. In other words, the November elections of 1932 weren't a kind of historical glitch or a hiccup. They were the beginning of a trend. The NSDAP's constituency was beginning to come undone. The Nazis, over the course of 1930, 31, 32, had been able to put together one of the most socially diverse electoral constituencies in German history. The Nazis had recruited most of their support among the middle class, particularly the Protestant middle class of Germany. But they had also done well with a host of other groups. They'd done surprisingly well with elements of the German working class, not workers in heavy industry or in coal mining, workers that were large, who would have been raised in a working class, social democratic or communist milieu, but among workers in small shops, artisanal workers, and workers in small scale manufacturing, and with agricultural workers. It allowed the Nazis to argue that they had crossed the great social divide, that they were not a class party, as the liberals were, the conservatives were, the socialists or the communists, but they were what the Nazis called a Volkspartei, a people's party, capable of transcending these social divisions. But in the aftermath of the election in 1932, this constituency had begun to unravel. And the Nazi leadership was extremely worried. They were worried because they believed that their policy of, on the one hand, negative campaigning had taken them about as far as it was going to. The other side of this Nazi, what I would call a catch-all strategy, of appealing to every single group within, or virtually every single group within German society, telling farmers that they're going to get higher prices for their for their products while promising workers in the city lower food prices. The contradictions of Nazi policy, if you added it all up, it was 2 plus 2 plus 2 equals 8. It never quite calculated. Their opponents never tired of pointing this out, and yet the Nazis continued this sort of juggernaut toward what appeared to be a parliamentary majority. What the Nazis now came to terms with by the end of 1932 is that all this was catching up with them. After the election, Goebbels commissioned a top-secret report to be drawn up by local propaganda operatives to say what went wrong. It was basically a post-mortem. How do we explain the fact that we've lost over 2 million votes in a matter of a few months? What's gone wrong? This document was meant for Hitler, for Strasser, Goebbels, and about three other high-ranking party officials. That report was devastating. What it said was, we've blown it. That we have managed to put together this remarkably diverse constituency, but it is quite clear that the vast majority of people who are voting for us are not committed National Socialists, are not committed to Nazi ideology. They are protest voters who are opposed to different failures of the Weimar Republic. We've been unable to bring them into the fold sufficiently. We've been unable to indoctrinate them, unable to make them good National Socialists. That the promises that the party had made were beginning to catch up. That the attempt to be both socialist on the one hand and middle class on the other was now working to the party's disadvantage. That this catch-all strategy had reached the limits of its effectiveness. Joseph Goebbels, writing in his diary in the spring of 1932, at a time when the Nazis were still moving from electoral victory to electoral victory, had written, and I quote, "Something's got to happen in the immediate future. If we don't come to power soon, we're going to win ourselves to death in these elections," close quote. By the fall of 1932, that's exactly what had happened to the Nazis. They believed, their own hard-headed assessment of the situation was, that they had a narrow window of opportunity to get themselves into power. And by the end of 1932, they'd missed the opportunity. This top-secret report, which incidentally I found in the German archives, hidden under tons of dust several years ago, this top-secret document concluded with the lines that whatever else happens, we cannot allow it to come to another election. If we do, then the results are simply too awful to contemplate. There was only one way, one possible way out of this terrible situation that the party found itself in. If, the report concluded, Adolf Hitler manages to come to power, to put himself at the head of a German government, then, and to show himself to be a man of action, capable of reversing the situation, then it will be possible, we believe, to restore some of the momentum and establish once again the popularity of the government, of the movement. As December of 1932 turned into January of 1933, nothing seemed less likely than Adolf Hitler becoming the next Chancellor of Germany. And yet by the end of the month, on the 30th of January 1933, Adolf Hitler did become Chancellor of Germany. It is one of the most monstrous ironies of Western, indeed human history, that at just the time when the National Socialist constituency was dissolving, when the popularity of the party was sliding, that Hitler was appointed chancellor, not as a result of some sort of inevitable popular success at the polls, but would be named chancellor as a result of a backdoor palace intrigue around Hindenburg's office. That's the story we'll take up in the next session.